All right, welcome to another deep dive. This time we're going to be exploring biblical prophecy.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Specifically, we've got this lecture transcript called Foundations of Biblical Prophecy. Lecture 14 really caught my eye, all about interpreting those, those sometimes confusing prophetic texts.
I can see why that would be a popular topic. There are a lot of different interpretations out there.
Exactly. So I figured this deep dive would, be helpful for all of us trying to make sense of it all.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, and this lecture goes into some really fascinating concepts, like double fulfillment.
Okay.
The idea that maybe one prophecy could actually refer to multiple events, even touches on how figures like Martin Luther viewed this whole topic.
That's fascinating and so relevant too, because understanding prophecy isn't just some ancient history lesson. It's about equipping ourselves with tools for understanding, the world around us today.
Totally. It's like, how do we make sense of these prophecies in light of everything happening today? So, guideline number one in the lecture is context is king. I feel like we've heard that before.
Yeah, definitely.
But why is it so important, specifically when we're talking about prophecy?
Well, you wouldn't try to understand a single line in a novel without knowing the whole plot, right?
Right, of course.
Prophecy's kind of similar. You have to start by analyzing the grammar, historical setting, the verses right around the passage you're looking at.
Okay, so starting small, like zooming in.
Yeah, and then, like ripping in a pod, you broaden your view to the entire book and eventually the whole Bible. It's about getting that full picture.
So no cherry-picking verses, huh?
Nope. I would see how they fit into the larger narrative.
Okay, makes sense. Now, the second guideline emphasizes figuring out who the prophecy is talking to or about.
Right, identifying your audience, so to speak.
Yeah, like knowing your audience. So, does it make a difference if a prophecy is directed to a specific group versus talking about someone else?
Absolutely. The lecture distinguishes between didactic prophecy, which is meant to teach a lesson, and predictive prophecy, which foretells future events. Knowing who it for is a key to understanding what it means.
That's really interesting. So, how do we even figure out who the target is?
It's like detective work. You got to ask questions. Is this prophecy addressed directly to someone, or is it telling them about someone else? If it seems predictive, are there any conditions attached, and has it already happened?
Oh, so like checking if it's already been fulfilled.
Yeah, and if so, where in the Bible can we find that fulfillment?
Okay, starting to feel like a puzzle.
It is, and every piece gives you a clearer picture.
I like that. So what's the next piece?
Guideline number three, fulfillment citations. These are specific phrases that tell us a prophecy is being fulfilled, like little flags saying, hey, this Old Testament prediction, it's happening right here.
Ooh, confirmation.
Exactly. Like a classic example is in Matthew 1:22, where Jesus's birth is fulfilling Isaiah 7:14. The gospel writer uses the phrase that it might be fulfilled, connecting the two.
Okay, so those phrases are like pretty clear indicators, right?
Mostly, yeah. But here's where it gets a little tricky. Sometimes fulfillment might actually point to an illustration or similarity, not a direct prediction.
Wait, so a prophecy can be fulfilled but not literally?
It's nuanced. Look at James 2:21-23. It talks about Genesis 15:6 being fulfilled, but not in a predictive way. More like highlighting a thematic connection between Abraham's faith and ours.
Ah, so fulfilled doesn't always mean a direct one-to-one prediction.
Right. And even certain Greek words, like pleros, fulfilled, and agiographtai, it is written, their meaning can vary depending on the context.
Okay, so no jumping to conclusions about fulfillment without looking at the nuances.
Exactly.
This is getting deep.
And now we're going even deeper. Guideline number four, the double fulfillment debate. This is where things get really interesting and maybe a little controversial.
Ah, yes. The idea that one prophecy could refer to multiple events across history sounds like a theological riddle.
It does, doesn't it? So the lecture explains this double fulfillment or double reference as the possibility that the same words in a prophecy could have multiple meanings pointing to separate events across time.
So one prophecy, multiple targets. Doesn't that get kind of subjective?
That's the debate. Some theologians, like Dwight Pentecost, they support double fulfillment. He calls it the law of double reference, argues that a prophet could be speaking to their own time and to a future time within the same prophecy.
Oh, wow. So speaking to multiple audiences across time.
Exactly. And another theologian, Eric Sauer, emphasizes how prophecy can blend the historical and the eternal, the human and the divine. He uses Isaiah 11:11-16 as an example, saying it refers both to the return from exile and a future kingdom of peace.
So in Sauer's view, those verses have a double meaning, referring to both a past event and a future one.
That's how he interprets it. But now, get ready, because here's where the debate heats up. The lecturer, Vannoy, he firmly disagrees with this whole double fulfillment thing.
Ooh, he's not holding back. Why does he disagree with it?
He argues that assuming multiple meanings within the same words, in the same context, well, It's a slippery slope. Can lead to all sorts of misinterpretations. He even calls it hermeneutically unsound, meaning it just goes against good principles of interpreting texts.
So he's saying that interpreting prophecy with a double meaning approach is not the best way to put it?
He's not a fan. And to support this, he brings in some big names. He quotes Martin Luther and John Calvin. Both of them strongly rejected the idea of multiple meanings in scripture, emphasizing the author's original intent.
Wow, he's going all the way back. Bringing out the classics.
And he doesn't stop there. He links this to the Westminster Confession of Faith, which also advocates for a single meaning in scripture.
So Vinoy is saying we should focus on finding one clear meaning in a prophecy rather than trying to find multiple interpretations that might not even be intended.
Exactly. He makes it clear this isn't just some theoretical debate. It impacts how we understand and apply the Bible to our own lives.
I could see how that could be a problem. Like, if every prophecy is open to multiple interpretations, it could get really confusing, lead to all sorts of misapplications.
Definitely a concern. And to further emphasize this point, Vinoy brings in some more modern voices like Bernard Ramm and J. Barton Payne, both respected scholars who raise concerns about how double fulfillment can just make it really difficult to objectively interpret and apply scripture.
So, like, if you're constantly looking for hidden meanings, you could miss the intended message altogether.
Precisely. And to illustrate this, the lecture dives into a passage that often gets the double fulfillment treatment, Deuteronomy 18. This passage sparks a lot of debate, especially when it comes to, you know, the role of prophets and how it relates to Christ.
Oh, Deuteronomy 18. Yeah, I've heard that one debated before. What's Vinoy's take on it?
He argues that the language there refers to the Old Testament prophetic institution. And while he acknowledges this can foreshadow or point to Christ, he doesn't believe the words themselves have a dual meaning.
So he's making a distinction between the concept of typology, where something concrete represents a greater truth, and typological language, where the words themselves have multiple meanings. Never thought about it like that before.
It's a subtle but important difference, and that's where another scholar, Milton Terry, enters the discussion. He's got some pretty strong arguments against double fulfillment. He lays them out in his book, Biblical Hermeneutics.
Okay, so is he on Team Vinoy then?
He is. Terry argues that accepting double fulfillment basically throws everything into uncertainty, makes it hard to interpret the Bible in a consistent way. He even points out that we don't really use double meanings in any other serious communication.
That's a good point. If we don't use double meanings in normal conversations, why would we assume they're in the Bible?
Exactly. He believes the intended meanings should be clear. But the lecture doesn't stop there. It gives some real-world examples of how double fulfillment is actually used in practice. That's where things get even more interesting. Ready to dive into those?
Absolutely. Let's see how this theory plays out in real-life interpretations.
Okay, so the first example comes from a Scofield Reference Bible. This study Bible has been incredibly influential in shaping how people understand prophecy. It focuses on Daniel 8, the passage about the little horn.
Ah, yes, the little horn. Always brings to mind some pretty intense prophetic speculation.
You said it. The Scofield Bible interprets this little horn as referring to both Antiochus Epiphanes, a historical figure who persecuted the Jews back in the 2nd century BC, and the Antichrist, that future figure associated with the end times.
Whoa, hold on. They're saying the same phrase is talking about both a past and a future figure. That's a pretty big leap.
That's double fulfillment in action. And it gets even more intricate. When you look at verses 10-14, which describe what the little horn does, the Scofield notes claim that the actions of both little horns actually blend in these verses.
Okay, now I'm really confused. So it's not just that the same words apply to both figures, but their actions are somehow intertwined. How does that even work?
It's definitely a point of contention. And to make things even more complex, the Scofield notes address the phrase time of the end in verse 19. They argue that both ends are in view, referring to both the end of the Grecian Empire and the end of Gentile times.
Wow, so this double fulfillment idea can lead to some pretty layered and intricate interpretations.
Definitely. And this is just one example. We'll be diving into more in the next part.
Okay, so we've heard argument for and against double fulfillment. We've seen how it's used in some popular interpretations. But where does Vinoy ultimately stand on all this?
Well, he wraps up the lecture with a crucial point. He doesn't completely rule out the possibility of double fulfillment, but he emphasizes that the burden of proof lies in demonstrating it through scripture.
So he's not shutting the door completely, but he's setting a high bar. You can't just claim it. You got to back it up with evidence from the Bible.
Exactly. He's advocating for a cautious and reasoned approach to interpreting prophecy. And I think that's a really valuable takeaway from this lecture.
Totally. And that brings us to the end of part one of our deep dive into biblical prophecy. You've heard both sides of the debate. You're armed with some essential guidelines.
Now you're ready to tackle those tricky prophetic passages.
We'll be back for part two, where we'll explore even more examples of how double fulfillment is used and dig even deeper into the arguments for and against it.
Stay tuned.
All right, welcome back to our deep dive into biblical prophecy. Last time we started uncovering two guidelines for understanding these these passages, and we even touched on that pretty heated debate about double fulfillment.
Right. The idea that a single prophecy could actually have like multiple layers of meaning and could refer to different events across time. It's a fascinating concept, but yeah, it can get a little complex.
It does. So before we jump into more examples, could you remind me again why this whole debate about double fulfillment even matters?
Sure. It's a great question. It really gets to the heart of how we approach prophecy, right? Are we looking for like one primary meaning that's rooted in the historical context? Or are we open to the possibility of multiple meanings sort of unfolding across time?
Right, yeah.
That answer, well, it can really impact how we interpret specific prophecies and how we, you know, apply them to our lives.
Okay, that makes sense. So the big question is, can prophecies have multiple meanings? I remember you mentioned the Scofield Reference Bible uses double fulfillment when interpreting that little horn in Daniel 8. Are there other examples where this approach is used?
There are. The lecture actually looks at another passage we briefly mentioned before, Isaiah 11. Remember how theologian Eric Sauer argued that this passage has a double reference?
Right. He saw those verses as speaking to both historical and future events.
Exactly. He said it referred to both the return from the Babylonian exile and a future kingdom of peace.
Yeah. But I'm also remembering that the lecturer, Vinoy, he wasn't totally on board with that whole interpretation.
You got it. Vinoy actually challenges that interpretation. He argues that the language in Isaiah 11 is really focused specifically on the return from exile, not some future kingdom. He emphasizes that if you pull it out of its historical context and apply it to some future event, you risk, well, misinterpreting what it really means.
So it sounds like he's saying we shouldn't try to force our own ideas about future events onto a prophecy that's really grounded in like a specific time and place. Isn't that kind of what we talked about earlier with the whole context is king thing?
Exactly. He's all about a grounded, historically informed approach to understanding prophecy. Remember Milton Terry?
Oh, right, Terry. The scholar who compared interpreting prophecies with double meanings to, like, riddles and enigmas. He wasn't a fan, was he?
Nope, not at all. He said accepting double fulfillment can lead to tons of uncertainty and disrupt a consistent way of interpreting the Bible.
Hmm.
He believed that words should have one clear meaning based on the context. We shouldn't be twisting them to fit our own ideas or expectations.
I see how that connects to this Isaiah 11 debate. If we say the language can refer to both a past and a future event, doesn't that make it, I don't know, really hard to figure out what the prophecy was supposed to mean in the first place?
That's a really good point. And that's why this debate is so important. It's not just some, you know, academic thing. It actually affects how we understand and use prophecy today.
Okay, so we've seen a couple of examples now of how this double fulfillment idea is used, and we've heard those arguments for and against it. I'm still kind of, I don't know, on the fence about the whole thing. Does the lecture offer any other helpful guidelines or tips for interpreting these passages?
You know, while it doesn't lay out more specific guidelines beyond those four we talked about, Vinoy does share a final thought.
Okay.
I think it serves as like a good guiding principle.
Okay, I'm all ears. What's the final thought? Does he finally say once and for all whether he's for or against double fulfillment?
Well, he doesn't exactly take a definitive stance, but he reiterates that he's skeptical. But he does say it might not be entirely impossible.
Okay.
However, he's really emphasizing that if you're going to argue for multiple meanings, well, the responsibility is on you to actually prove it.
Ah, so it's like innocent until proven guilty. You have to make a strong case for temple fulfillment.
Exactly. He says, and I quote, "If you are forced to view that by scripture itself, so be it. But you must demonstrate from scripture that that is the way you must understand the statement, which bears a high burden of proof."
Hmm. So he's urging us to approach prophecy with a critical eye.
Yes.
And demand strong evidence for those interpretations, especially when they involve these multiple layers of meaning.
Exactly. It's easy to get swept up in the excitement of figuring out prophecy, but we have to remember to let the text, you know, let the text do the talking, not just read into it what we want to see.
Right, right. It's about letting the text guide us, not the other way around. And while typology and the possibility of multiple fulfillments, you know, they're interesting ideas.
Yeah.
We shouldn't let them become our starting point, right? We need to be anchored in what the text actually says.
Perfectly said. And remember, interpreting prophecy isn't always about finding like a perfect answer. Sometimes it's about, you know, embracing the mystery and allowing those words to challenge us, inspire us, maybe in new ways.
This whole deep dive has really given me some new ways to think about prophecy. I feel like I'm starting to get a handle on how complex it is.
Me too. And I think that's what's so great about these deep dives. They give us the knowledge and the tools to think about think about these difficult topics in a more thoughtful way.
Well said. So are we ready to move on to some more examples in the next part?
Oh, absolutely. In part three, we're going to take a much closer look at some specific passages that are often interpreted with this double fulfillment lens, including that one we started talking about earlier, the little horn in Daniel 8.
Okay, so we're going to be putting all of these guidelines we've talked about into practice.
Exactly. We'll examine the arguments and see if they really hold up.
This is getting good. All right, deep divers, you don't want to miss part three. We're going to tackle some of the most debated prophecies in the Bible. Stay tuned. All right, welcome back, deep divers. We're in the final stretch now of our journey into biblical prophecy. It's been a fascinating exploration so far, hasn't it?
It really has. We've uncovered so much about how to interpret these prophetic passages. And of course, we've wrestled with that pretty thought-provoking concept of double fulfillment.
Yeah, the idea that a single prophecy can actually have multiple meanings that like play out over different periods of time. I have to admit, it's really gotten me thinking.
It's definitely a concept that challenges us to think deeply about how we understand prophecy. So in this final part, are you ready to put all of our newfound knowledge to the test?
Absolutely. Let's dive into some specific passages and see if we can unravel those layers of meaning.
Okay, great. Let's revisit Daniel 8, specifically that section about the little horn that we talked about before. You might remember that the Scofield Reference Bible, which has been a really influential study Bible, it interprets this little horn as referring to both Antiochus Epiphanes, that historical figure who persecuted the Jews back in the 2nd century BC, and the Antichrist, a future figure associated with the end times.
Right. So the same symbolic figure is seen as representing two different individuals across like centuries. A classic double fulfillment interpretation, right? But if I remember correctly, you had some reservations about that approach.
I did, and this is where those guidelines we've been discussing become so essential. Remember how we talked about the importance of context? Well, when we look at Daniel 8 carefully, we see that it's really grounded in a specific historical context.
Okay.
The vision is given to Daniel during the Babylonian exile, and, well, the imagery and the language, it points directly to events that were happening, you know, related to empires rising and falling all around that time.
Ah, I see. So are you saying that the historical context of Daniel 8 really supports a more immediate singular fulfillment rather than a double fulfillment that stretches into the, you know, distant future?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting. When we really examine the specifics of the prophecy, we find that that description of the little horn actually aligns pretty well with Antiochus Epiphanes and, well, what he did. He emerged from one of the divisions of Alexander the Great's empire. He persecuted the Jews. He desecrated the temple in Jerusalem. And in the end, he met a pretty violent end. All of that, it lines up with what the prophecy describes.
That makes sense. So if the prophecy seems to have this pretty clear fulfillment within its historical context, why would anyone interpret it as also referring to a future figure like the Antichrist?
It's a fascinating question. You know, sometimes interpreters draw connections between historical events and future events based on, well, perceived similarities. They might see some shared characteristics like themes of persecution or false worship or a climactic battle, and then they conclude that the same prophecy must apply to both.
So it sounds like they're basing their interpretations on these like broader patterns or connections rather than the specific details of the prophecy itself. But couldn't that lead to some pretty subjective interpretations? I mean, couldn't people just see what they want to see?
That's definitely a valid concern. While typology, which is, you know, the study of how different parts of the Bible connect symbolically, can be a helpful tool for understanding scripture, it's important to use it carefully. We want to avoid forcing prophecies into preconceived ideas about the future.
I'm starting to see how crucial it is to let the text speak for itself, rather than trying to read into it what we already believe or what we, you know, want to see happen. Are there any other examples of passages that often get interpreted through this double fulfillment idea?
The lecture does briefly mention Isaiah 7.44, that prophecy about a virgin giving birth to a son named Emmanuel. This passage, well, it's often cited as an example of double fulfillment, the idea being that the first fulfillment was a child born during Isaiah's time, and the second fulfillment was the birth of Jesus.
Yeah, I've heard that interpretation before. But that passage, well, it always seems to be one of the most debated in the entire Bible. Everyone has a different opinion on what it means.
You're not wrong. The lecture actually doesn't go into great detail about Isaiah 7.14 because, to be honest, it's such a complex and nuanced passage that it would probably require a whole deep dive of its own.
I can imagine. But it sounds like a really good example of how that double fulfillment debate can lead to, well, very different interpretations of the same text.
It certainly is, and it highlights how important it is to approach those passages with a lot of careful study, close attention to the original Hebrew text, and a willingness to really engage with a variety of perspectives.
So we've revisited Daniel 8, touched on Isaiah 7.14, both passages that are frequently seen through that lens of double fulfillment. As we wrap up our deep dive, are there any big takeaways you'd want to leave our listeners with?
You know, I think the biggest takeaway is simply this. Interpreting prophecy is a process. It requires a lot of thoughtfulness. It requires a lot of careful analysis and a grounded approach. It's not about, you know, hunting for those hidden meanings or trying to force a prophecy to fit what we already believe. It's about paying attention to the historical context, paying attention to the specifics of what the prophecy says, and really considering the overall message of Scripture.
That's a really good point. It's about letting the text, you know, letting the text guide us, not the other way around. And while the idea of typology and the possibility of these multiple fulfillments are, you know, intriguing, we shouldn't let them become our starting point. We need to stay rooted, anchored in what the text actually says.
You put it perfectly. And another thing to remember is that interpreting prophecy isn't always about finding like a definitive, clear-cut answer. Sometimes it's about wrestling with the mystery and allowing those ancient words to, you know, to challenge us, to inspire us in new ways.
Well, I can definitely say that this deep dive has given me a whole new set of lenses for how I view prophecy. I have a much better understanding of how complex it can be and why it's so important to approach it thoughtfully and responsibly.
I'm so glad to hear that. And remember, this is just the beginning of your journey. There's a whole world of prophetic literature out there waiting to be explored. So we encourage you to keep digging, keep asking questions, and keep engaging with the text in a thoughtful, meaningful way.
That's a great reminder. So to all of our listeners out there, we want to encourage you to embrace that challenge. Embrace the wonder of biblical prophecy. Don't be afraid to dive deep, explore those different perspectives, and really allow those ancient words to speak to you in fresh and unexpected ways.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive. Thanks for joining us.
We'll see you next time.